The U.S. and Canada cooperate to airlift thousands from Gustav's path. The Valkyria Airport Advisory Board is finally put out of its misery. And NASA rethinks trusting Russia for launch vehicles after 2010. This is Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for downloading this AeroCast. Here's what's up in aviation for Tuesday, September 2, 2008. The Federal Emergency Management Agency appears to have learned from its debacle in Hurricane Katrina 3 years ago. Yesterday, as Gustav approached the Louisiana coastline, the agency settled in for the first reports from the storm, confident it had done all it could to be ready. The U.S. Transportation Command, based in Illinois, coordinated the evacuation of 16,000 special needs citizens out of the affected areas. Canada sent a CC-177 Globemaster III aircraft, the Canadian version of the C-17, to help evacuate people from Louisiana. Even though the storm was downgraded from Category 4 to 2 before landfall, the levees protecting New Orleans remained a question mark. As Gustav moves north today, heavy rains and tornadoes are expected in Texas and Arkansas, and the damage assessment will get underway along the Gulf Coast. The so-called Valkyria Airport Advisory Board, which had come to serve as little more than a venue for enemies of that Central Florida airport, has officially been disbanded. The board was disbanded by a 3-2 vote of the Brevard County Commission on Thursday last week following decades of internal bickering. Florida Today reports the breakup vote followed numerous speakers who complained that the board's often obvious bias against the airport blocked progress on a 20-year master plan and needed improvements. The beginning of the end may have come earlier this year when Brevard Commissioner Chuck Nelson appointed vocal airport opponent Janice Walters to the advisory board. Palm Bay City Councilman Milo Zonka may have said it best at the time, quote, "Hiring an arsonist as fire chief would surprise me less," unquote. 10-year advisory board member Russell Minton said a proposal to repave runways to stop chunks of loose concrete from flying into propellers was fought by the board, which considered the maintenance a pro-growth measure. Jill Lyles, secretary of the Melbourne Area Pilots Association, observed, quote, "It is especially counterproductive for a board to have members who object to the mission of the airport to fly aircraft," unquote. So how will local officials work now with residents on airport issues without the board? Well, it's hard to imagine it being any worse. Russia's recent invasion of former Soviet state Georgia reportedly has NASA rethinking its plan to retire the U.S. space shuttle fleet. Plan A up to this point was to retire the shuttles in 2010 and rely on Russian launch vehicles to service the International Space Station until NASA's new Orion program is flying in 2015. The Associated Press now reports NASA recently ordered a quiet study of options for extending shuttle flights past the September 2010 retirement date. Safety, though, is a significant concern. NASA's shuttle launch record has been exemplary following the 2003 loss of Columbia, but program managers concede that risks are rising as the fleet ages. NASA Administrator Michael Griffin calls the shuttle an inherently risky design. He told a Senate panel in April, quote, "We currently assess the permission risk as about 1 in 75 of having a fatal accident. If one were to fly the shuttle for an additional 5 years, say 2 missions a year, the risk would be about 1 in 12 that we would lose another crew," unquote. Let the cost-benefit debate begin. Crew members aboard the International Space Station had to take the unusual step last week of firing booster rockets to lower the station's orbit to avoid a chunk of space debris that may have come within a mile of the station. MSNBC reports the firing is the first time in 5 years the ISS had to be maneuvered to avoid such debris. Usually, the capability is used to lift the station's low Earth orbit to reduce drag from the fringes of the Earth's atmosphere. That drag lowers the station's altitude by 100 to 300 feet per day. But this time, the station was already near the top of its allowable altitude, so crews were forced to fire the rockets to lower the station's orbit. Wasteful, but necessary. The debris involved comes from the Russian Cosmos 2421 surveillance satellite, launched in June 2006 to keep track of Western naval vessels. The satellite exploded on March 14th this year, likely due to a self-destruct command issued by Russian officials. The satellite broke apart further April 28th, and then some more on June 9th. The Russians have denied responsibility for the debris. Somebody call Maury Povich. Coming up next, Boeing's best and final offer results in a strike recommendation. Unions say it's time for Boeing to admit 787 outsourcing has failed. And machinists end their 29-day strike against Hawker Beechcraft. You're listening to Aero News.
Diamond Aircraft's new DA-40 Diamond Star XL includes all popular Diamond options, combined with the sensational new Garmin GFC 700 Autopilot, a higher performance power plant, and increased gross weight. This makes the Diamond Star XL the perfect choice for affordable personal flying. The Diamond Star XL features equipment and enhancements that increase performance, capability, safety, convenience, and comfort. Visit Diamond on the web at www.diamondair.com or call 888-359-3220.
Finally, aviation headsets have evolved. Clarity Aloft merges the most advanced technologies from the fields of hearing science, aviation communications, and performance audio. Clarity Aloft headsets use Comply canal tips, composed of soft, viscoelastic foam, the same foam tips used in advanced hearing aids. The noise-canceling microphone is optimized for speech frequencies in high-noise environments. The low-profile headband is featherweight and comfortable. Just three reasons why you need to feel and hear the difference a Clarity Aloft stereo headset can make for you. For more information, call 612-747-3197 or check out the innovative Clarity Aloft headsets on the web at clarityaloft.com.
We're back with more of your Aero Briefing for September 2nd, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. As we welcome you back from the U.S. Labor Day holiday weekend, there's lots of labor news to report. On Thursday, Boeing presented what it called its best and final contract offer to almost 27,000 employees, represented by the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers in Washington, Oregon, and Kansas. Boeing says it's offered a general wage increase of 11% over 3 years, beyond cost of living adjustments it says will add close to another 3%. The proposal would up the pension contribution to $80 per month for each year of credited service. It also provides a lump sum payment, a first vote ratification bonus, an incentive pay plan, and what the company calls outstanding health insurance at a fraction of the cost most Americans pay. Boeing claims that on average, the offer will provide employees with $34,000 in additional pay over the term of the 3-year contract. Boeing also withdrew a proposal to stop offering early retiree medical coverage to individuals hired in the future, as well as a proposal to negotiate a separate contract for Boeing employees in Wichita to better align the company's operations in Kansas with competitors in the military aircraft modification business. The union immediately rejected the package and urged its members to strike. The rank and file get their turn to vote on the pact tomorrow. The Society of Professional Engineering Employees, International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers Local 2001, is criticizing Boeing's approach to solving 787 Dreamliner outsourcing issues as, quote, lip service until action is taken to correct problems created by a global network of suppliers and inexperienced workers, unquote. Executive Director Ray Goforth complained, quote, continued statements that everything is fine with the 787 global supply network just don't fly, unquote. Unions, including the IAM, are upset about work outsourced to offshore firms and have already proclaimed the effort a failure. Goforth urges the company, quote, face the fact that the global network is a failure and bring the critical work back so the experienced employees can get the 787 back on track, unquote. The 787 program is about 18 months behind schedule. Last month, Azerbaijan Airlines became the first airline to cancel a 787 order. Nearly 5,000 members of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers in Wichita and Salina, Kansas, will soon return to work at Hawker Beechcraft after winning a new contract that increases pay by 4% per year while preserving health care benefits and the rights of new hires. Members of Local 733 and 2328 voted Thursday last week by a wide margin to ratify the new agreement, which was reached a week ago today. Machinists struck the company August 4th in the first work stoppage there since 1984. 90% of the union's membership voted to reject the company's initial 3-year offer, and 89% authorized the strike. That strike lasted 29 days. Attempts to find a buyer for Italy's struggling Alitalia Airlines have been sabotaged by unions, politicians, and government officials who drove away potential white knights with untenable conditions for a takeover. Meanwhile, the airline has lost an estimated €1 million a day, running up against a European Union prohibition against continued government subsidy. Now, the Italian government has taken the only remaining option. Thursday, Italy modified its bankruptcy laws to facilitate the airline's official fall into insolvency. That status means the airline can continue operating for the time being, and some analysts say it may emerge as a leaner, profitable carrier. Bloomberg reports that a group of investors, headed by Piaggio chairman Roberto Colaninno, has proposed what is being called the Phoenix Plan for Alitalia, as in rising from the ashes. Investors would put up $1.5 billion to take over what's left after the airline sells off its unprofitable units, slashes jobs, and merges with its largest domestic rival, Air One. In the search for capital, Air France KLM Group is bound to be mentioned. It submitted a $1.17 billion offer to take over Alitalia earlier this year. That offer was accepted by the Alitalia board, but scuttled by the aforementioned unions and politicos over issues of 2,100 job cuts and undervaluation of existing shares. The unions may be second-guessing that opposition now. A more recent reorganization plan put forth by recently elected Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi would chop 7,000 jobs. Still ahead, McCain's VP pick is a friend of general aviation. Eads denies an Airbus deal with Syria. And are you ready for a fly-by-wire helicopter? You're listening to Aero News.
Uncramp your style in a new Citation CJ2 Plus from Cessna. Now with integrated ProLine 21 avionics, FADEC, and a restyled cockpit and cabin. In the CJ2 Plus, you'll carry more payload than you could in the original CJ2. You'll climb and cruise faster. You'll have the freedom to use even shorter runways, and you'll do it all on less fuel. For a sure thing, call 1-800-4-CESSNA.
We're back to wrap up your Aero Briefing for Tuesday, September 2nd, 2008. I'm Paul Plack. Arizona Senator and U.S. presidential candidate John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, grew up hunting and fishing in Alaska before she became the state's governor. If you'd guessed she'd be a fan of general aviation, you'd be right. The Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association notes her contributions. Quote, in May 2007, she signed a resolution in opposition to the FAA's plan to increase avgas taxes, impose user fees, and slash airport funding. AOPA and the Alaska Airmen's Association had worked together to move the resolution through the Alaska legislature, unquote. In January of this year, Governor Palin unveiled a new Alaska Aviation Safety Initiative aimed at reducing accident rates among the state's pilot community. AOPA adds that Palin's husband, Todd, is an AOPA member and the owner of a Piper Super Cub. AOPA adds that neither presidential campaign has yet published a position on general aviation issues. AOPA has sent both campaigns questionnaires and says it will publish the answers from both sides in the November issue of AOPA Pilot Magazine. That should be in your hands before Election Day, November 4th. AOPA has no plans to actually endorse either candidate. Mindful of the political ramifications of doing business with a state sponsor of terror, last week European Aeronautic Defense and Space Corp vehemently denied its Airbus division was on the verge of announcing an airplane deal with Syria. The rumor erupted as French President Nicolas Sarkozy prepared for his visit to Damascus this week. Last November, a visit by Sarkozy to China ended with a 160-plane order for Airbus jets. Reuters reported it had confirmed the deal, which would see Syria make the order in exchange for Eads' help in reorganizing its national carrier, Syrian Air. Reuters cited two unnamed sources in its story. Airbus would face two significant hurdles in selling any of its planes to Syria. For one, the deal would violate U.S. sanctions imposed on Syria since 2004. One industry official told Reuters the workaround might involve selling the planes to a leasing company, which would then lease the planes to Syria. A bigger obstacle, though, might be the political ramifications of the deal, especially given the current bidding war with Boeing to build the U.S. Air Force's next aerial tanker. As electronics have begun to replace mechanical linkages on airliners, a debate has emerged over the so-called fly-by-wire control technology. The newer systems send pilot control inputs as digital commands to external actuators, which in turn move control surfaces. The idea has proven hard for some flyers to embrace, to put it mildly. Now, Sikorsky is bringing the debate to the rotary wing world. On Friday, Sikorsky says it made the first flight of its UH-60M upgrade Black Hawk helicopter, the only fly-by-wire rotorcraft currently in flight test development within the Department of the Army. The announcement came only 2 days after word of the first flight of the Sikorsky X-2 rotorcraft technology demonstrator, which uses a similar control system. Stick commands make their way to the rotor head via dual-channel, triple-redundant flight control computers. The advantages over traditional mechanical linkages are less weight, lower maintenance, better performance, better protection, and enhanced survivability, and they allow an increased role for electronics in reducing pilot workload. The UH-60M's test flight lasted about 60 minutes, Sikorsky Chief Test Pilots Mike Skaggs and Steve Silder maneuvered the aircraft through a variety of exercises, including hover, forward flight, and a hover turn at Sikorsky's West Palm Beach facility in Florida. The first of about 900 UH-60M upgrade aircraft is expected to be delivered in the fourth quarter of 2010. And finally, can you believe it's been a half century since Grumman Aerospace test pilots Carl Aber and Fred Rowley took the first Gulfstream 1 twin-engine turboprop on its maiden flight? Last month marked the 50th anniversary of the birth of what is today a flourishing market for business aircraft. The G-1 first flew over Grumman's then headquarters in Bethpage, New York, on August 14, 1958. The FAA certified the plane on May 21, 1959, and soon afterward, the first delivery followed to Sinclair Oil. The G-1 was designed specifically for business travel, but it also saw service with five U.S. government agencies and all branches of the armed forces. The FAA acquired its first G-1 in June of 1959. In the 60s, parts of the Apollo Lunar Module traveled from Grumman to NASA aboard a G-1 fitted with a cargo door. Grumman delivered its 200th aircraft in 1969, when production of the G-1 ended. About a third of them are still flying in 15 countries. Gulfstream Aerospace evolved out of Grumman Aerospace and is now a wholly owned subsidiary of General Dynamics, has manufactured more than 1,800 aircraft, and offers seven business jets at a wide range of prices in its current lineup. The U.S. was falling into a recession in 1958, but it wasn't a bad year for new product introductions. Toyota, Nissan, and Intel all made their U.S. debuts that year. So Gulfstream was in good company. That's the latest from Aero News. Remember to check out the ANN special feature. We were off yesterday, so CFI Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves makes a rare Tuesday appearance today to explain how long-term goals help students complete their flight training. And if you haven't done it yet, subscribe to our AeroCasts. Find them on iTunes, Yahoo, Odeo, and at our website, www.aero-news.net. That's Aero spelled A-E-R-O. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.